Welcome, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, Hints and Tips to Get You the Most out of IBM DB29 for ZOS. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes. In this teleconference, you'll learn about the wealth of new features in DB29 for ZOS. You'll see how its new features improve business efficiency and reduce costs by increasing the productivity of administrators and programmers. The speaker for today's teleconference is Namik Hurl, IBM Distinguished Engineer, IBM Software Group, Information Management. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Hurl. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thanks to the audience for joining today's teleconference session. I assume you have opened the presentation file and you are at the title page. As I go to the charts, I will refer to the page I'm on so you can follow the presentation. DB29 for ZOS brings a wealth of new features that improve productivity of administrators and programmers, and this presentation shows how some of the common database administration and programming tasks can be done more efficiently in DB29. It also presents some hints and tips about less obvious usage capabilities of selected DB29 features that efficiently solve long-standing programming challenges such as application control locking, destructive reads, efficient mass deletes, etc. So please move to the next chart, chart number 2, which is the usual disclaimer. So we won't dwell too much on this one, and move to the next chart, chart number 3. DB29 is functionally very rich release, including features from traditional DB2 strengths such continuous operations, performance, scalability, and so on, to the categories that have been in the customer focus for a while now, such as portability and total cost of ownership reduction. This chart attempts to list most of the features, and you can see there are really many. 1 hour is certainly not enough to cover them all, and I will not even mention a large number of very interesting features, for example, XML support, to name one. But I still hope that you will like the selection I made, especially because for most of those not mentioned, DB2 library and publications listed at the last page of this chart deck provide a pretty good description and usage guidance. Before we move to the concrete features, let me stress that although DB29 brings this large number of new functions, it doesn't have the architectural changes that were characteristics for DB2 version 8, and consequently the migration is much less challenging. Therefore, for those of you who had some challenges during DB2 version 8 migration, rest assured that DB29 experience should be less eventful, let me put it this way. So let's start with concrete features then. Please move to the next chart, chart number 4. As you know, DB2 version 8 introduced a select from insert, which is an efficient way to retrieve all the values that a newly inserted row has. Therefore, not only the values specified at insert itself, but also those generated by DB2, such as identity columns and sequences and defaults, expressions, row IDs, and so on. Of course, the same result can be achieved by a separate select statement that immediately follows the corresponding insert, but apart from reducing the number of calls to DB2 and associated cost, the select from insert prevents you from experiencing possible performance issues associated with the fact that the separate select could result in an inefficient access path, whereas select from insert is always automatically using the most efficient way to retrieve the inserted data. Now, with version 9, DB2 extends the concept to the rest of modifying operations, meaning updates, deletes, and merges. As with select from insert, a single trip to DB2 makes the row changes and returns all the changed values back to the application. The benefits are pretty self-explanatory, but let me draw your attention to an interesting usage of this feature. With the select from delete, we practically got a mechanism to code destructive read. A destructive read is an operation which automatically deletes the data that has been just returned back to the application. A typical usage of destructive read is on tables that are used as data queues. While a set of application processes registers events and records them in such a table, another set of processes reads the table and performs specific actions required by the recorded events. Once such an event is read and processed, it can be deleted. So instead of coding separate select and delete statements, a single select and delete can have basically the same effect. Of course, if the subsequent processing would fail, the rollback would reinstate the deleted job. So let's move on then. Please move to the next chart, chart number 5, where I will present the next feature and its usage. DB2 has supported order by and fetch first and rows clauses for a long time, as you know. However, not within a subselect. So you could specify, for example, select from T1, order by C1, fetch first one row only, but you couldn't include the same construct in a subselect like the one with insert you see on this chart. Well, in DB2.9, that limitation has been lifted, and both order by and fetch first and rows clauses can be included in both, a full select and a subselect. Again, the programming productivity advantages are obvious, as more functions and processing can be pushed into DB2. But I would like to draw attention to not-so-trivial use of the new feature that actually solves a long-standing issue that many of the application programmers have been struggling with. The issue is with statements that acquire and concurrently hold too many locks. Take, for example, archiving process. Periodically, many rows are moved out and deleted from the table. If all the rows are deleted, a single delete without where clause doesn't accumulate any low-level locks. But if the delete includes a where clause, like, for example, limiting the time interval for which the rows should be deleted, each of the affected rows will be exclusively locked and held at least until the statement completes. The mechanisms to prevent holding too many locks that we have prior to version 9 are limiting the number of locks that any process can hold or any table space can accumulate. And as you know, in the former case, the exception leads to the affected statement's abnormal termination, and in the later case, it leads to lock escalation. None of these are, of course, really good, and in DB2 version 9, we have a very nice way to deal with this. Look at this example on the chart. Because DB2.9 allows the fetch first and rows in a subselect, we can code a delete that incrementally deletes a block of rows that need to be deleted, committing after each of the blocks of deleted rows. In this example, we delete 10,000 rows in one chunk. Commit after that and repeat the block deleted as long as the select retrieves rows that satisfy the delete condition. This way, we do not accumulate more than 10,000 rows or locks at any time. Of course, you can use a different number for the block size depending on how many concurrently held locks you are really willing to accept. Please move to the next chart, chart number 6. Assume that you have an application that experiences lock contention. There are some hot rows that need to be accessed concurrently, and the concurrent processes access the rows with incompatible serialization attributes. This is, of course, a common application design problem, and there are many different ways to address it depending on the application semantics. In this particular case, let's assume that the application requires committed rows, therefore uncommitted to read. That is not and cannot be used, but it is okay not to get back rows that are locked by other applications that are concurrently running. So the semantics could be described as requiring available, meaning not locked, but committed rows. So if the row is locked, it's simply skipped. A good example of such an application is a message queue. While a set of application processes registers messages and records them in a table, Another set of processes reads the table and performs specific actions required by the recorded messages. The process that reads the message or the messages must get committed ones only, but it can afford to miss those that are being locked at the time of the read. Namely, these locked messages or rows will likely be available next time the read process visits the queue. DB2 version 9 provides exactly the described semantics. The new skip locked data option can be added to one of the statement types you see on the chart and allows the statement to skip over rows that are incompatibly locked by other transactions without being locked. Well, here again, I have a tip for somewhat non-trivial use of this feature. Assume that you need to code application control access to serializable objects. In other words, only a single application can access the given object at a time. Prior to version 9, you have coded this by creating a table with a row that each application needs to access and exclusively lock. So the serialization is done on that row. However, this can lead to serious contention problems. Assume that the semantics you need is okay with getting an immediate feedback that the requested object is not available, so the process can do something else and revisit the object later. For this case, you can code select for update of skipped log data, and the application will immediately get SQL code plus 100 in case that another application already has the exclusive control over the required object. There are no waits in DB2, and there are no possibilities for deadlocks. So the same technique can be used for specifying the number of applications that can concurrently get a control over an object. Simply insert as many rows in the above table as there are allowed concurrent applications. Please move to the next chart, chart number 7. In DB2 version 8 and prior, we had three basic techniques to retrieve log values. Number one, we could fetch into a buffer which size is large enough to receive the largest possible log value. Obviously, in terms of performance, this is the optimal approach, but cannot be reused for logs where the maximum possible size is too large. Well, in some cases, this wouldn't work at all because simply there is no available memory, and in most cases, it results in an efficient storage utilization. Then, the second way we can do the thing is that we can fetch into a smaller buffer, again, but hoping that most of the log values will fit, and those that do not need to be retrieved with separate calls. The inefficiency here, on the other hand, is that the buffer truncation is not accompanied by the actual log size, so the additional calls to DB2 need to be made. And the last technique is to, of course, use log locators. This technique is very storage efficient and often the only available viable option with very large size logs. But at the same time, it's very inefficient, actually, with small logs, jokingly sometimes called slobs. Namely, when using the locators, retrieval of rows with logs require additional multiple trips to DB2 for the locator's handling. With DB2.9, we have a very efficient mechanism to retrieve logs, the new fetch continue option. When retrieving the base row, we code fetch with continue instead of just fetch. And then, if the log is not returned in its entirety, follow with fetch current continue. This provides opportunities for two additional techniques for the log retrieval. The first one is to fetch into moderately sized buffer, expected to fit most values. If it doesn't, then allocate larger buffer using the actual log length returned on the fetch. And now, knowing the log size, followed by a fetch current continue to retrieve the rest into the resized buffer. The second technique is true streaming. Specifically, you should specify a relatively small buffer, for example, 32K, and then move and reassemble log data pieces into a larger buffer or type it into an output file. Please move to the next chart, chart number 8. DP2.9 introduced a number of new data types, such as big integer and decimal floating point, but in this presentation I'm going to mention only binary data type, which comes in both fixed and variable end flavors. Prior to DB2 version 9, we have used forbit data on character fields to store binary data. But there are problems with this approach, and these problems are really connected with the way that forbit data is padding KD characters and comparison rule, which is still comparison rule for the characters. We are just abusing character fields to put the binary data. And the problems were that character fields, even if you specify forbid data, are padded by zero, by blanks, which is basically, as you know, depending on SQL deficit, it's 2-0 or 4-0, while real pure binary data should be padded by 0-0. Secondly, even more importantly, it's really comparison. So if you compare two strings that are character forbid data, they will follow character semantics, where the shorter string will be actually padded to the length of the longer string, and then the comparison made. While for the real binary data, for the bit data, that shouldn't be done, and the two strings are equal up to the length of the shorter string. The shorter string is then considered less than the longer string. And DB2 version 9, with its new data type, binary for fixed-length binary string and var binary for variable-length binary string, exactly allows us and provides us with the needed semantics. Please move to the next chart, chart number 9. Assume you have an application where basically there is a very critical high insert rate workload, and you are experiencing performance problems with that thing. I guess you must have had that thing, because the high workload inserts are quite often applications nowadays. You have already applied all the conventional tuning steps, and there is one mitigating circumstance, which is that clustering is not really beneficial, and either it's not beneficial, or you can actually afford more frequent reorganizations. In DB2 version 8 and prior to that, we could use a so-called MC00 insert algorithm. And MC00 insert algorithm is the algorithm that kicks in if you specify your table space with a specific parameters of member cluster yes, free page zero, percent free zero. In this particular case, the insert will basically go to the end in most cases, and it will avoid searches for the most optimal candidate page for inserting in a clustering sequence. In DB2 version 9, we actually get this particular option or similar option on a table level. So where we can actually specify on a create table, or we can alter table, an option which is called append, and if we specify append yes, the result will be a faster insert at the end of the table or a partition. However, there will be, of course, expense of subsequent data reorganizations and rapid space growth, because we will never go back and reuse the space. So if you can afford reorganization to reclaim the space, and if you want the fastest possible insert performance without benefits of clustering for subsequent range predicates, then append yes is the very good option. It is, as I said, it is similar to MC00. It's not exactly the same, because MC00 still attempts under certain circumstances to go back and reuse the space that's been deleted, while append will basically always go up and go to the highest page. Please make sure that all the service has been actually applied, as you can see on this particular chart, because there was some service that was related and that made this feature working correctly. Move to the next chart, chart number 10. Here I'm going to talk about so-called reordered row format, as opposed to basic row format that's been in DB2 since the very beginning. With the basic row format, we actually gave application designers and programmers advice that they should define fixed length columns preceding their variable length columns in the row. With DB2 version 9 and reordered row format, DB2 basically internally implements this recommendation. And it provides faster direct access to variable length columns and, of course, then potential for significant CPU reduction. You know, it will be used for the newly created tables, and for the old ones, you can actually get it activated through reorg, with some exceptions that you will see later in this presentation. In some cases, reordered row format can lead to increased log volume, but actually, more importantly, in some cases, reordered row format can actually lead to deteriorating compression ratio for compressed table spaces. And for that particular reason, we actually provided some service, and you can see it here on this chart. PKA7348 provides a reorg option that actually gives you an option to convert table space from reordered row format to basic row format and vice versa. It also provides support for basic row format by universal table space, and because originally universal table space was supported only with the reordered row format. And it also introduced public ZPAM instead of hidden ZPAM, that basically a ZPAM that is telling DB2 with which row format a newly created object should be really created. PK78958, on the other hand, provides an option to convert RRF actually for the compressed page sets not to go into RRF if that actually leads to the lower compression ratio. Please move to page 11. This is an interesting and long-standing topic and challenge on how to determine that a particular new index would actually benefit for a given dynamic SQL query. Or, you know, how to determine that dropping an index would not negatively affect a given query. So, in many cases, predicting based on modeling is not really reliable because you know yourself how complicated the optimizer is, and the whole query optimization is very complex, so the prediction is not really reliable. Then, if you just add indexes into the system, that definitely creates a permanent overhead for most of the SQL and utility operations. Also, creation of the new indexes is really obtrusive for concurrent operations. And if you would like to avoid all that and do the changes and addition of the new indexes in the test system, then you basically lack really the potentially real-life situation, because in many cases environmental factors are different between productive and test systems. Well, with DB2 version 9, we have an option which is called virtual, or we can call them hypothetical indexes, where we can actually specify an index and mark it as virtual, and then it will be used for the explain statements. It will not be really created. It will not have this overhead of maintenance. It will not have an overhead of creation. But there will be a table, which is called DSN Virtual Indexes Table, in which you would actually specify the index, and you will see on the next page how that actually specification looks like. And at explain time, during query optimization, these virtual indexes would then normally be taken into account as the regular indexes are for normal cost-based optimization. And also the dropped indexes or virtually dropped indexes would not be really considered. So that really gives you an opportunity to assess the impact of adding or dropping an index on an existing workload. If you go to the next page, page 12, you will see how this table virtual indexes actually look like, And this is a table that you will have to populate in order to, in quotes, create an index. So as you can see, you will have to give creator, name of the index. You will have to say, is it enabled or disabled for explain processing. You also have to say, is it really created? Is this created, new index, or it's one of the existing one which is dropped? And then usual things like number of columns, unique, group, clustering. But you can see also something very interesting. You also can add actually some of the basic statistics of what this index would have. Together with that, you will also have to have the cluster ratios and then the number of columns and real columns that are used in an index and the keys, ordering sequence, and so on and so on. Moving to page 13, prior to version 9, in many cases we have found the systems with lots of indexes for which we are not really 100% sure if they are needed or not. Because when the problem with the access path problem arises, and very often customers just create an index, but maybe the problem was transient, or the particular application is not used anymore. But how do we know that we can really drop such an index? Having indexes in the system that are not needed is really unnecessary overhead, unnecessary significant cost in maintenance of these indexes during inserts and deletes and loads and reorgs and so on and so on. So, in DB2 version 9, we have a very simple technique to find out if a particular index is really used by the system. In the real-time statistics tables, we are adding a new column called last used, which is updated whenever this index is used in a select or search update delete or referential integrity checking and so on. It's of course not updated for inserts and loads, therefore for the operations that basically cause updates of the index. And then if a particular index hasn't been used for a period of time, and you have to be really sure that this period of time covers the entire application life cycle, for example, be sure that some periodic jobs like some kind of period closings and so on are really covered in this interval. If the index, as I said, is not used, then it can be probably safely dropped. But of course, you have to be careful with that. This is just an additional signal or a help for you to find out if a particular index could be dropped or not. Moving to the next page, page 14, again in DB2 version 8, we know that we had various ways of deleting a content of a table, meaning entire content of the table. If the table is in the segmented table space, delete is already very fast. You know that we do not really have to visit every row on the pages with the delete without where clause in the segmented table space. We can do it very, very fast. However, it can be really fast if we have some delete triggers defined on the table, regardless of the organization of the table space. For the partition table spaces, we could actually use load replace by specifying an empty input data set, and it is also a very fast way of basically deleting or emptying the content of a table space. But there are some packages and some package applications that do not like to use utilities. They would like to use SQL in order to do a very fast delete. And we would also like to have the storage that is occupied by the deleted rows to be, available as soon as possible. With DB2 version 9, we get a new DML statement, which is called truncate table, which is basically, in terms of the performance, very similar to delete without where clause. But the additional capabilities above what delete without where clause provides is that you can specify that you can actually ignore delete triggers, so the operation is fast even if there are delete triggers. You can specify that all storage that is allocated for the table is released and made available for use for the same table or any other table that resides in this table space by specifying the drop storage option. is always at a table space level, and that the allocated space is always available for use by all tables in the table space. You can specify reuse storage, which means that all storage that is allocated for the table will be emptied, but will continue to be allocated for the table. And then you can also specify an interesting feature, which is called immediate, and that means that the truncate operation is processed immediately and cannot be undone. So if the immediate option is specified, the table must not contain any uncommitted updates. In the case of a table in a simple table space, the entire table space must not contain any uncommitted updates, or the truncate operation will simply fail. Okay, so please move to the next chart, chart number 15, which is just one example of a new statement, which is a merge statement in DB2.9, which is basically a combination of insert and update, and for a set of input rows. So we should update the target table when the key exists and insert the rows for which keys do not exist. One typical example is, again, in archiving, for activities whose description, for example, has been changed, update the description in table, and for the new activities, insert into this table. So you know that prior to version 9, this has been coded and could be actually coded as a loop over conditional insert and update statements. And with DB2 version 9, I have here one example that is basically combining two set of values. One of them is in values in input records. Another one is in the table account. And it's pretty self-explanatory here what kind of results you are going to get after the execution of the merge statement. Please move to the next chart, chart 16. And here I'd like to talk something about unique data partitioning secondary indexes. Data partition secondary indexes have been introduced in version 8, and they've been very, very useful, especially in data sharing and parallel systex environments with very heavy insert, because they can significantly reduce the cost of index maintenance at these insert operations. And inter-data system interest and data sharing overhead. There's one limitations of data partition secondary indexes, and this is that they cannot be really created as unique. And the reason is kind of trivial, because we would like to try to avoid scanning all of the partitions of the data partition secondary index in the case when uniqueness needs to be enforced. And in some cases, this has been an obstacle for wider usage of data partition secondary indexes. Now, with version 9, we are relaxing this limitation, because really, if the columns by which the table is partitioned are actually part of the DC, then when insert occurs and when uniqueness needs to be checked, only the corresponding DeepC partition need to be visited. So in DB2 version 9, DeepC can be actually created as unique, but subject that fulfilling this condition. And as I said, that the columns by which the tables is partitioned are actually contained in the DeepCs. So please move to the next chart, chart number 17, universal table spaces. As you know, in the past, we've been always challenged by a dilemma of what kind of table space we should define for our application. In some cases, partition table space fits better the workload and the access patterns. In some cases, segmented table space. But what if we need a table space that really needs both of them? So it needs to be kind of partitioned because it's larger than 64 gigabytes. It is also nice to be partitioned because we would like to have some kind of or take advantage of inter-partition parallelism. But at the same time, the rows are really variable in length because they are either compressed or they are varchar. And we would like to have actually optimal space utilization, which is provided at insert time on segmented table space. Or we would like to take advantage of segmented tablespace mass delete operation performance. Obviously, we need a tablespace then, which is both partitioned and segmented. And this is exactly what DB2 version 9 actually delivers. It delivers a hybrid tablespace, it's called universal tablespace, which is both partitioned and segmented. And as you can see on this chart, for the first time, you can actually specify in the same create tablespace both segment size and number of partitions, which, by the way, before would really result in a syntax error. There are some limitations here, and these are, for example, that only one table can be in the universal tablespace. And another limitation is that universal tablespace cannot be defined as member cluster. Therefore, you know, the MC00, for example, technique that I talked about earlier could not be used. There are two types of universal tablespaces. One of them is called partition by growth, and I'll talk about that on the next chart. And another one is called partition by range, which is just by traditional partition tablespace that we all know. Please move to the next chart, chart number 18. And as I said, this is about partition by growth feature, which resolved the problem and challenge when the table growth is actually unpredictable. So we can start relatively low and relatively small, but we do not know how large and how fast this table can actually grow. If it grows more than 64 gigabytes, then we know that we had to partition. But the problem with partitioning in many cases is that there is no really convenient key for partitioning. And in DB2 version 8, we have been using, for example, for this problem, partitioning by row ID, which is kind of almost like a random partitioning. But there are some issues about that. And these are like issues about estimating optimal number of partitions. You know, we couldn't add partitions if necessary. You know, the space is not really used in an optimal way and so on. Now with DB2 version 9, we are introducing something which is called partition by growth, where on the creation of the table space, we simply say how many partitions this table can actually have, and we can change this number by basically specifying at older time. Or we can specify on the creation of table that this table is partitioned and that each partition, each chunk, is of certain size. Now, each tablespace in this case would actually start as a single partition, and then when the size of the specified is actually clicked over, we are opening up another partition. So we do not have to have a keys, we do not have to have a table control partitioning, we do not have to have a key at all. We are just adding new partition as this tablespace actually grows. There are some real considerations that I would like to draw your attention to. Rio can, for example, for partition by growth tablespaces, add new partitions. It can add new partitions, for example, when it's reestablishing free space. Rio will also not remove empty partitions, even if it can collapse the whole content into a smaller number of partitions, but it will actually shrink them to contain just a header and space map page, however, subject to absence of large objects and XML columns. Because one of the problems with partition by growth is that when we reorg, the columns or rows that contain lobs cannot be actually moved from one partition to another. And this is another consideration that you should have actually in mind, because it can have serious ramifications. For example, you run out of space due to updates on varchar or compression and so on, and you would like to reorg to reclaim the space or reestablish the space. Well, that will not really work. You will need to unload, drop, create, and load. Also, if you want to recluster partition by growth, it is really recluster with the partition, not across partitions. Please move to the next page, chart, page number 19. And in DB2 version 9, we are introducing larger index page sizes. Larger index page sizes really help in heavy insert applications where prior to version 8, very frequent index page splitting would actually cause and would happen. You can recognize that. You can detect that. by, if you are in data sharing environment, by looking at accounting class 3, synchronous log write suspension timer and counters, or for non-data sharing, by looking into the record trace of IFCID 57 and look for a specific latch class 254. If any of these happen, then DB2 version 9 new feature, which is providing larger index page sizes, can actually help. The advantages are obvious. First, if you have a larger index page sizes, it can certainly reduce index page splits because the index page splits will happen later. You can also traverse shallow indexes because the indexes will be shallower if the index page sizes are larger, and index scans will be faster. On the other hand, there will be disadvantages because larger pages require larger buffer pools. So, if your access is predominantly random, then the buffer pool for the indexes where you actually change the sizes to be larger might need to be correspondingly larger. And in the data sharing, the larger index page sizes can result in more PLOC contention. So, the rule of thumb that I would like to offer here is that the 4K index pages should be continued used for indexes with a random insert pattern, and to avoid frequent splits, you should specify larger percent-free parameters. And for the indexes with sequential insert patterns, I would ask you to consider, or would recommend you to consider, larger size index pages. Moving to page number 20, DB2 version 9 is introducing index compression. On this chart, you can actually see a difference or comparison side by side between table compression that you've known for quite a long time, since the DB2 version 3, I guess, where we can compress data in a table spaces, and the newly introduced index compression. As you can see, the unit of compression, for example, is different. With table space, it's row. For index compression, it's page. And I won't go through every single one. Many of them are here self-explanatory. Something which is really interesting and I would like to draw your attention to is that the compression actually happens for index compression at I/O. So not at insert and fetch, like it happens normally for table space compression, but at I/O. Therefore, the CPU overhead of index compression is affected by buffer pool hit ratio. So, and if you can make the indexes basically resident in the buffer pools, the overhead of index compression will be very, very small. Okay. Please move to the next page, page 21. In DB2 version 9, DB2 will use 32K page work files much more frequently than it actually did before. It will the old 4K page work files are used only for the small records, where basically where the limit, as you know, that we have a limit of 255 rows per page. So if that limit would actually cause a waste of space, if the work file is in 32K page, then DB2 will use 4K. The recommendation here is that in DB2, as you migrate to DB2 version 9, you should assign a larger 32K work file buffer pool. You already had it. I'm sure that you already had it even in version 8. But now you should assign a larger one. You should allocate more of these work files. And then if you see in the statistics, in the DB2 instrumentation and monitoring, that the 4K work file buffer pool activity is really lower, then you can potentially, you know, reduce the size of the corresponding buffer pools and work file data sets. DB2 version 9 provides the new statistics that is telling you how often the more optimal 32K work files actually ran out, and 4K had to be used, and vice versa. So that can really help you in planning to find out the optimal size and the number of the work files. Moving to page 22, in DB2 version 9, we are close to finish basically the task and the journey we started back in version 7 to provide a backup and restore at the system level and to avoid micromanagement of backups and through image copies and so on. With DB2 version 9, we have a full integration of tape devices into both backup system and restore system. We can use system-level backups as alternative sources for recovering individual table spaces in Nexus, and this reduces significantly the need for using in parallel image copies. But here I would like to draw attention to a fact that you still cannot perform object-level recovery for system-level backup if the data set has moved away to a different volume since the backup was taken. For example, there was a point-time recovery to before point of reorg with inline copy, or a storage administrator decided to move data sets around to defragment volumes, or it was migrated to new density, or so on. Well, in these cases, you really need to use, for example, a tool like Recovery Expert or some other ISV tool that provides a similar function. Backup system now also supports incremental flash copy functionality, which really helps in the overhead that is driven by the flash copy, by the full flash copy being done all the time. DB2 can also be restarted in system point in time recovery mode, and this is without truncating the logs to a prior point in time, which means that the restore system now can be actually used to recover DB2 to current end of log. So far, we've been only using a restart system to do that. And there are some changes in modifier recovery. Moving to page 23, next page. In DB2 version 9, we are adding capability to rebuild index online, which is really used in the cases when you identify a performance problem, access path problem, and you see that an index should be added. And instead of waiting for the batch window where that can be actually done, because in DB2 version 8 and prior to that, building an index, rebuilding an index is really a pretty disruptive operation, now you can actually do it online in both share-level reference, share-level change mode, and you know these modes from a reorg that's basically equivalent. If you move to next page, page 24, with DB2 version 9, we are basically providing a DB2 controlled way of changing some of the parameters for which before we really had to do some risky operations in changing the VCAT, schema, owner, creator. So we could do all those kind of things, but it was always dangerous to do that because it involved changing some of the parameters we don't like user to change, preserving coherency between the catalog dictionary and actual physical object and so on and so on. So it was very, very error prone if somebody wanted to change any of these parameters. Now that with DB2 version 9, we actually added a cat main options to do the changes that will be controlled by DB2, that will do proper performance, proper authorization, semantics checking. It will ensure coherency between catalog, dictionary, and actual physical objects. So it will help a lot in operations like, for example, cloning of database systems, where very often when you clone, you would like to change one of these very high-level identifiers like VCAT or schema or so on. Please move to the next chart, page 25, which is presenting that DB2 version 9 introduces new identifiers that can be used to qualify resource limit facility and that actually can help to qualify and control and to govern processes that are coming from applications that so far have been shown to DB2 in such a way that no granulation or no fine granulation could be done. Namely, most of these applications actually connect to DB2 with some kind of technical user ID, and because RLF prior to version 9 could have been only qualified by the plan name, user ID, authorization UID, original one, and location name, all these identifiers for these applications are basically the same, regardless of what kind of workload is really pushed into DB2. So you couldn't really use RLF. Now with DB2 version 9, all the identifiers that we introduced in version 8 for workflow management and accounting, like end user ID, end user transaction name, end client workstation name, IP address of the application server. All these identifiers can be used for qualifying the requests coming into DB2 and using governor or resource limit facility to control resource utilization by these requests. Moving to page 26, it's about not log tablespaces, and as I said here in the title, please use it with really extreme cases only, because DB2 doesn't really have a problem with log performance. There are very rare situations where the log write latching or log data set write bottlenecks could be actually experienced, and under very controlled environment and very controlled conditions, we could switch off log for a table or two and then switch it on, of course, after that. Typically, the process of doing that would be that you would take a full image copy of this table space, then turn off logging for the table space, then do the massive changes and be sure that there are not some concurrent, non-repeatable changes happening at the same time. Then you would turn on logging and then take full image copy. Of course, you know, this actually ensures that even if something goes wrong, you can always go to the full image copy that you took before turning off logging, and it can actually improve the overall performance of the import of the data. Moving to page 27, it's showing that in DB2 version 9, we are leaving more of the space in DBM1 address space by moving most of the EDM pool that has been already, by the way, above the bar, but moving the rest of the biggest consumers of the DBM1 above the bar, like EDM skeleton pool, like EDM RDS pool, parts of RDM's pool, and so on and so on. As you know, statement pool and DBT pool, they have been already above the bar. So if you move to page 28, you will see that all the changes that we did in EDM pool and in the thread pools and the virtual storage in DBM1 actually, you know, moved most of the data or most of these memory pools above the bar. So we will be able actually to run more concurrent threads in DB2 version 9. Do not expect some dramatic improvements there. As a matter of fact, DB2X is going to bring these factors better improvements. But 200 to 300 megabytes more in DBM1 address space for these challenging applications that are using lots of DBM1 address space could be expected. There are some changes in ZPAMs that control thread virtual storage utilization, and I included them here, documented them here on this particular chart. So you can see here these are the cached in free lock and mean store that are basically set now to yes in order to better control the thread virtual storage. And with that, moving to page 29, I would like to conclude the presentation with a list of very useful references in the form of these red books and red papers. And now I will like to hand it back to the moderator.
Thank you, Namik. Now we'd like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will not have a Q&A session today. Now, your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. Question one, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star one. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. And I will pause for a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to respond. 2, how was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. Once again, we'll pause for a moment. Question 3. What version of DB2 for ZOS are you currently using? If version 9, press star 1. If version 8, press star 2. If version 7 or below, press star 3. Once again, we'll pause for just a moment. Question 4. Do you plan to update in the next 6 months? If yes, press star 1, and if no, star 2. And ladies and gentlemen, we'll pause for just a moment before asking our final question. And our final question for today, we hope that you have enjoyed today's teleconference. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving additional information or follow-up regarding the products discussed today. If yes, press star 1, and if no, star 2. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our survey for today, and that does conclude our conference call. Thank you for your participation.